Welcome to the Duke University Philosophy, Politics, and Economics Lecture Series for 2011. I'm Michael Munger, Director of the PPE program at Duke. This series is made possible by the generous support of Duke University, the Thomas W. Smith Foundation, and the Charles G. Koch Foundation. These speeches are in the public domain, but any use of this material must clearly identify the source, as both the name and affiliation of the particular speaker, as well as the Duke PPE program. We hope that you enjoy these lectures as much as the audiences did.
Well, it's a pleasure for me to introduce today a man I've known for a bit and have known of for a long time. William Gradisson is here pretty occasionally at Fuqua, and so I was able to take advantage of one of the times that he is here to have him to talk about financial systems and regulations. Let me give you a little bit of background about Bill. There are three really important committees in the House of Representatives. One of them is the Rules Committee, which is just for misanthropes that hate everyone, and Bill wouldn't have been on that committee. The other is the Appropriations Committee, where it's really always a party and you're just able to give away other people's money, and Bill wouldn't have been on that either. The committee where all the work gets done is called Ways and Means, and Bill was on that committee for long enough to have seen things that no one should ever have to see, but also to have played a really pivotal role in the passage of three or four very important tax reform bills. After leaving the House of Representatives, he served on and was acting director of, for a while, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, which was the new agency that was created under Sarbanes-Oxley, partly in response to the dot-com bust and problems that that we had had with the financial system, but also with accumulating difficulties with oversight of accounting. Oversight is very different from overlooking. Overlooking is what we had been doing for accounting. So Bill is going to be able to tell us, I think, both about some problems and solutions. And I think he's going to be able to stay until 5:30. He's going to go join the Occupy Wall Street people then at 5:30, but he doesn't have to leave until then. So Bill Gradisson.
Thank you. I've been looking forward to being here. When you mentioned the Ways and Means Committee, as some of us who served on it used to refer to it as the Committee on Woes and Moans, which is probably a little bit more accurate. I'm going to pass something around here. I encourage you to take a close look at it, and when it comes back up, I'll just have a word to say about it. There's a little history of related to the Ways and Means Committee, which I think tells you a lot about the way government operates. Prior to the Civil War, the Ways and Means Committee in the House was responsible not only for revenue raising, but also the expenditure side of government. And as you may recall, the Constitution provides that all revenue raising measures must originate in the House of Representatives. So that committee had a very important role to play on taxation, but also on spending. At the time of the Civil War, the burden on the committee became simply too great for one committee. And it was a decision to divide it into two committees. One would be the Appropriations Committee, the one that spends the money, and the other would be the Ways and Means Committee, the one that raises the money. And that division took place, and it's continued to this time. The trivial pursuit question, which I think will answer itself, is this. The then chairman of the joint committee before it was divided had a choice of whether to serve on the spending committee, appropriations, or the revenue committee, ways and means. But just to state the obvious, he chose to be on the appropriations committee because it's a hell of a lot more fun spending the money than it is raising it. I really don't like to stir up controversy. I might today, so I want to tell you about something that happened when I was a student at Yale 100 years ago. I was a major in political science, and we had a teacher who had taught in Germany and had taught in Britain before he came to Yale. The particular lecture that I have in mind was about Marxism. And he was about halfway through his lecture when he slammed his papers down. And he looked us in the eye and he said, "I have given this lecture in Germany and I have given this lecture in Britain. And at this point, by this point in the lecture, there are people standing in the aisle, shaking their hand, wanting to argue with me. And all you guys do is just sit there and take notes." And he walked out of the class. So we hope not to. Feel free to join the people at Freedom Plaza, but that can be after we're finished here today. I want to kind of give you a preview of where I'm coming from on this question before I get more specific. I think there is a human conceit to believe that we can predict the future and also that we can understand the past, that we're smarter than those who came before us, that we have learned from experience, that we have put effective structural reforms in place. Indeed, that this is a new era. Or to quote the title of a book I strongly recommend to you, This Time is Different. I think it's fair to say that since the Great Depression, there has been an idea that has taken root in this country that economic crises, at least major economic crises, such as the one we're going through right now, are a thing of the past, and that we had systems in place, automatic stabilizers and other actions, to keep this from happening. Well, you know, obviously that hasn't been the case, and I think it's worth inquiring a little bit about, you know, what went wrong and what this might mean for the future, even if you accept my notion that we may not be smart enough to be able to put all of our problems behind us. Actually, to have a run from to about 2008 or 2009 is a pretty good period of time. It just isn't forever. While it's hard to define systemic risk, I think the general idea of systemic risk is that it involves more than one company or more than one nation, that the financial difficulties in one part of the economy spread almost like a virus throughout the other parts of the economy, maybe not all of it, but many, many parts of it. Systemic risk can arise from a number of different causes. The major ones have been excessive debt, often mortgage debt, but not just mortgage debt, accumulated during economic booms. But it can happen with all kinds of debt. Government debt, or now we're hearing the term quite accurately, sovereign debt as it's applied in Europe these days. Bank debt, business debt, consumer or household debt. That is non-mortgage consumer or household debt. History is replete with examples of what has gone wrong, and there are very good records available at least back over at least 200 years that help to explain this. Interestingly, the one data set that is the least reliable in trying to understand what went wrong then, and frankly, what is going wrong now, is information with regard to government debt, and in particular, which you might call off-the-books government debt, which we have had in spades in this country. Here it may be commitments implied by our assurances with the entitlement programs. It could be Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, whatever. The debt limits often, borrowing amounts, seem to be quite reasonable and manageable during good times, and that's often when people get a little over-exuberant, and they make decisions which they come later to regret. Warren Buffett, who has a way with words, said in his usual colorful language, "You don't know who's swimming in the nude until the tide goes out." And I think that's a pretty good way to explain what happens with regard to excessive debt. I want to give you a little bit more specific examples of what can go wrong and actually has gone wrong time after time, because there may be a tendency to think, well, you know, this is a situation just happened to us here, or it's just happened in Greece. Well, that's really not quite the case. The sovereign debt issue, or more likely sovereign default, is being played out, of course, day by day, painfully long period in Europe, and the longer they wait, the worse the problem appears to be becoming. And it is complicated by the fact that they have set up a monetary union, the euro, for 17 of the 27 EU countries, 17 of the 27 participate, but they don't have a fiscal union. So there's no central authority involved in managing their accumulation of debt or their level of spending and taxation and things of that kind. The banking crises can also be caused by just a panic, a run on the banks. We pretty much saw that in the United States because of deposit insurance. The people up to the maximum, which is pretty high now, are protected with regard to their deposits, and if they go above the maximum they can divide it into various, more than one bank, and be fully protected. For example, in Great Britain, we saw, just a couple of years ago, a run on Northern Rock, a bank which admittedly was troubled, and the run reached a point where people were in line, stretched around a block, you know, waiting to get their money out. Ultimately, the government had to come in, or chose to come in, and bail them out. There all can be bank solvencies, bank failures due to insolvency, due to simply losses on their loans. There are a number of examples of that in recent years. Probably the best known are the ones in Iceland and in Ireland. Interestingly, Ireland had a relatively conservative fiscal policy. Their debt going into this crisis was maybe 25% of GDP, which in Shakespeare might say, looking at our situation, would be a consummation devoutly to be wished. You can say they panicked or they were responsible or they were overdid it, whatever. But they chose to go in and guarantee all the banks. And as a result, ended up with huge debts for Ireland, which are starting to work off. Iceland had a big boom in property values. Their banks attracted a lot of cheap capital from around the world, which was, as it turned out, invested in ways which were pretty risky. I was over there hiking in Iceland. My wife and I were over there this summer, and we were told that at the peak, before everything fell apart, a dollar would only buy 59 of their crowns, their unit of currency. And when we were there, I think it was 115. I mean, think about that in terms of obligations that they incurred that had to be paid in harder currency, such as our own, and you start to see the pain and suffering that's being inflicted within their own country. And within the United States, we're having banks closed almost every week. They usually end up being announced on Mondays. What happens is the FDIC comes in on a Friday to the institutions which are insolvent, whose loans values, the value of the loans have dropped to the point where it's basically wiped out their capital. And by Monday, the institution is reopened under another name because there's a deal made by the FDIC with a stronger financial institution to take over the weak one. We're up to around 75 order of magnitude that have closed this year, a number which is pretty consistent with what has happened in this country in recent years. None of those is really a big headline, although we've had some big ones in the past. Even in the localities where they're located, they may not be a big headline, because, as I said, the depositors are protected, the shareholders, of course, are, and many times the employees, are wiped out. Another thing that can cause a financial ruin is changes of exchange rates. For years after the Second World War, there were agreements with regard to fixed exchange rates. They were tied back to gold and tied back to the dollar. Those were abandoned. Generally speaking, countries have floating exchange rates, and when they don't, as in the case of China, it becomes a national issue here, debated as recently, I think, as yesterday on the floor of the United States Senate. Switzerland's a good example of what's going on, because when I talk about currency values can be too high, not just too low. For example, in Switzerland, the problem is that it was considered such a sound currency that people were buying Swiss francs and selling their domestic currency in a flight to safety. This was pushing up the value of the Swiss currency to a point where their exporters were crying uncle. I mean, it was pricing their exporters, which are very important in a country like Switzerland, you know, out of the world market. So the government stepped in and indicated that it was going to put a ceiling on the value of their own currency, sort of the opposite of what happens in a lot of other countries, like Argentina a few years ago. The Swiss, as I recall it, announced that they would not permit their currency to go above 1.2 euro. Remarkably, they had to back that up with very few purchases. Once the announcement of that took place, people took the government seriously, and the price just adjusted to that new reality. Another thing that can cause extraordinary problems is very high inflation. And I mean by very high inflation, say persistent inflation, and this is arbitrary, but persistent inflation over a period of years at a rate of, say, better than 40% a year. I'll cite an example off that chart later on. But we have not been totally immune from that. We have had gradual inflation in this country for a long time. But there was a period back around 1790 where we experienced approximately 200% inflation in just 1 year. So it isn't just everybody else. It can happen here as well. But what we've had is much more gradual. But one thing, there are a few advantages of old age. I don't think there are a lot, but I give you one. I can remember back during the Great Depression, my father at the time was serving as a member of the city council in our hometown of Cincinnati, and we talked about these things, that the salary of a policeman and fireman was $1,250 a year. That is probably somewhat equivalent in purchasing power to what a policeman or fireman gets today, but the dollar values, of course, are dramatically different. And the significance of that is that if you were a saver, depending upon the future purchasing power of your savings, and you live long enough, you're really, really in the soup. During the Great Depression, it was possible to live a modest but comfortable middle-class existence on the income from a capital sum of $100,000. Now, I'm not trying to say $100,000 isn't significant, but when you think about what it would take today, you can see that gradual inflation can cause a lot of problems, not only in terms of international competition, but within a society. Basically, it wipes out, high inflation wipes out the savers, and it puts many pensioners in truly dire straits just in terms of economic survival. So in a sense, there's nothing really new under the sun. Historians have identified examples going of each of these things going back over a long period of time, and I'm just touched on a few to make this point that it's not new. But historically, these did not tend to be what we might today call systemic, because they didn't easily spread from country to country. Now, with the internationalization of business and finance, that is not the case. And we are much more interdependent. I'll be more specific about that in a minute, but the measure, even the mention of Swiss exports, I think begins to make the point. But I picked this example because I love it. In the 4th century BC in Greece, the king found himself heavily in debt. So he issued a decree that all money in circulation, which at the time was coins, gold and silver coins, had to be turned over to the government on pain of death, which you get a pretty high response rate with a threat like that. In fact, there was something very similar about turning over currency and exchanging it in North Korea just a couple of years ago. After the king collected all the coins, he stamped every one drachma coin with a 2-drachma mark and used the money to pay off his debts. That's one way to do it. Another thing you may have heard of clipping coins, it was not unusual for the monarch to reduce the gold or silver content of coins physically by cutting out a little bit of the coins. There are some other examples. There was one English king who, again, was heavily in debt, and he solved his problem by appropriating, by confiscating all the property of the Roman Catholic Church and then selling it. There were others who were a little more direct. They executed the people from whom they had borrowed and then confiscated their assets. So there's a long history of this. But that was in the days of coinage, of having gold or silver, something, behind the currency. We now live in a world, take a close look at that dollar bill and what it actually says, or one you may have in your own pocket. We now live in a world of fiat currency. The government says this piece of paper is worth a dollar, so by God, it's worth a dollar. Now, you know, what it might buy, and that's something else, again, or what it might enable you to do if you're traveling in Switzerland might be something else, again. A lot of big countries have defaulted multiple times. The record is held by Spain, which has defaulted 13 times, and France, which has defaulted 8 times, although, frankly, not in recent history. The United States has never defaulted. although, of course, we, to make this point very strongly, we've had our share of systemic crises, particularly the Great Depression, but that wasn't the only one. The Federal Reserve was created as a result of a major banking crisis that happened just prior to 1913. So sometimes you do get a response to some of these situations that occurred. I think that to redescribe what happened here as a subprime crisis is really not very accurate. It's not inaccurate. It was partly that, but it was a lot more than that. We had many things happening here which have been historically characteristic of financial crises in other countries, such as asset price inflation, especially in housing, but not just in housing. Rising leverage, which led to the default of Lehman Brothers. A large current account deficits. The significance of that is that when we're buying a lot more from abroad than we're selling, and this money gets recycled back into our country through buying government securities, something ultimately happens to that increased money supply. And in the United States, there is some reason to think, although it's of course indirect, that our large current account deficit helped to finance this explosion in housing prices by keeping interest rates on mortgages as low as they were. The Canadian experience is kind of interesting on housing. They don't permit the deduction of interest, mortgage interest on their tax returns. They were consistently requiring down payments of much more than ours, I think in the order of 20%. And they didn't have the problems that we had before the downturn. Interestingly was that the home ownership percentage in Canada was almost exactly the same as it was in the United States. And today it may be higher because our home ownership rate, obviously, is going down. One of the great ironies of this is that we have had downturns in our economy since World War II, but they tended to be short. They tended to be triggered by inventory adjustments, where businesses had built up too much inventory, cut down production, worked down the inventories, and then things picked up again. The government response in virtually every one of those downturns was to encourage home construction by reducing mortgage rates. Here we have a situation where the Fed, through this twist they're trying to do, no doubt they'll be successful in bringing down mortgage rates, which are already at extremely low levels historically. But whether, to use an old Fed expression, you can push with a string, whether that will actually stimulate much in the way of additional purchase of mortgages, people borrowing through mortgages remains to be seen. But this wasn't, as I said, just subprime housing. The household sector had very high debt limits in addition for home equity loans and credit card debt as well. Personal savings rates were near zero. Total household debt in the United States had a historic average up until today, since 1951, of 37% of GDP. At the peak in the second quarter of 2009, it was 76% compared with that 37. And it's now down to 66% as compared with the 76%. Movement in the right direction. Regrettably, part of this is a result of a downturn in household debt resulting from bankruptcies and foreclosures. Some of the debt just get written off. It doesn't necessarily reflect increased savings. It shouldn't be surprising to us, therefore, that aggregate consumption spending is flat. I mean, I'm not quite sure what else we would expect. Families are trying to deleverage by reducing their debt. Many are increasing or trying to increase their savings. An increasing number are delaying retirement. The number of people age 65 that are in the workforce has actually been going up, even though total employment levels have been going down. And people trying to make up for the fact that they're not financially, they thought they were financially prepared for a retirement, but they found realistically that they no longer are. These are painful adjustments, and if history is any guide, they're likely to be very slow. The average recovery period for employment levels and the stabilization of housing prices in other countries has been about 5 or 6 years. But lest that give you some comfort, because you might say, well, we've been at this for 3 years. It's a long time, but we only have maybe 3 more years. Japan has been going through this kind of an adjustment for 17 years. It isn't quite finished yet from what I read in the numbers. Still, the United States, unlike many, if not most other countries, has time to turn things around without default, without currency, a debasement, because we are still the principal, not the only, but the principal reserve currency in the world, and no competitor is in sight anytime soon. The euro, which, by the way, holds about a quarter of the world's financial reserves, if not zero by any means, the future of the euro, to say the least, is somewhat uncertain right now. We'll see how this plays itself out. I don't think people, businesses, governments, or individuals seeking safety are rushing into the euro at this moment. And the Chinese RMB won't be a real alternative until China has a more open market and a floating exchange rate, which I think is entirely possible. I was really struck in a book I was reading a few days ago by a statement which I believe is correct. I looked up the source. It really got me kind of between the eyes. China had the world's largest economy for all but 200 of the last 2,000 years. In the year 1820, China's economy was one-third of the world's economy. By 1850, percentage-wise, it sort of dropped off the charts downward as the United States, Britain, Germany, and France, and some others got heavily industrialized. But needless to say, China is very quickly catching up. And one thing that struck me over the years about China, I've never visited there, but like a lot of us, read a lot about it, and this may be apocryphal, it may not have happened, but I've read that one of the leaders of China, since the communist takeover, was the French Revolution a success? And the answer was, it's too early to tell. I think that kind of a long-term perspective is worth giving a little thought to. The privileged status of the dollar is not just because of what happened in the United States. An important explanation is the financial toll on the UK of two world wars. They were really certainly one of, if not the dominant currency in the world for a long time. But they had to spend incredible amounts making purchases in other countries, including our own. They were selling everything they could that they could get into dollars, including a lot of securities in US corporations during the Second World War in order to get money to buy things that they needed for their own survival. But having said this, I will take a whole lot of comfort from the fact that we have time. The question is, what do we do with this time? It could, by being the major reserve currency, because it could be as much a curse as a blessing. It could facilitate too much borrowing or the printing of too much money. It may actually put off needed changes rather than putting us under the gun to do something. Another great irony is that this growing concern about the possibility of a worldwide double dip, which is something they're concerned about, has strengthened the dollar as investors have sought safety by buying dollars in spite of the fact that the interest rates that they get are very, very close to zero. They're just a little, and if you do it in inflation adjustment terms, they're minus. Because, well, you get back dollars and maybe 0.5% or 1% interest. Obviously, if the inflation rate is more than 1%, you've lost purchasing power, although you still get dollars. Were the United States, right now, an emerging market, the events following the subprime debacle would have caused the exchange rate of the dollar to plummet and domestic interest rates to soar, because that's just kind of how it works out in other countries. Happily, we're not experiencing that, and that's a blessing, to be sure. This interconnectedness of the world's economy has never been clearer. I'll give you just a few examples to make that point. In the United States, yes, the trigger of the crisis was excessive bank holdings of risky mortgage debt. A lot of that mortgage debt was repackaged and sold all over the world, so it already was influencing foreign banks, the financial condition of foreign banks, and foreign investors. In Europe today, much of the risk is from bank holdings of sovereign debt, debt payable in euros. This is debt of their own governments. Something like 45% of the bonds of European governments are held by European banks. So if there is a default or a partial default, let's say in Greece, it has huge ramifications all through their banking system. Here I want to get a little bit technical to make a point of how this works, because it has a lot to do with the financial stability of banks. Banks operate with significant leverage. A bank doesn't have, take in $100, they don't just put it in a vault. They invest it, if they can, in securities or in loans. Generally speaking, a bank in this country is considered strongly and soundly capitalized if they hold equity capital equal to about 10% of their lending, of the investments plus the loans. And often it is less than that percentage. Just to drive this point home, if you give them $100 and they invest in $1,000 worth of loans, and those loans go down in value by more than 10%, their equity is wiped out. The bank is insolvent. So this whole thing is very, very highly leveraged, as you can see. Now, you got a question from bank regulatory point of view. How do you value these loans that the banks have on the books? And that is a really major question, particularly in France right now. There is some evidence, and I don't pretend to have direct sources, but from what I've read, that in some instances, the banks have been valuing their investment in foreign currency, such as Greece's borrowings, not currency, but foreign sovereign debt, either at par, which is the full amount, assuming it's all going to get paid, or at haircuts. Now, haircut of different dimensions. A haircut is simply how much you shave off the apparent value to recognize that it isn't worth what it is, what came on the books at. You might have bought $100 worth of Greek debt, but if you think it's worth 50, you take a 50% cut. Haircut, it's value 50. In some instances, there is evidence that some of the banks over there are taking 20% haircuts, even though the current market value of the debt is 50 cents on the dollar. Now, in this country, we've gone through a lot of really difficult exercises in the audit field about how that sort of thing should be valued. And the first choice, if a bank holds securities that are available for sale, which is a word of art, available for sale, you look at the market, and if there's a market value, that's what you use. If you don't have it, that's called level one. Level two is that you take a look at comparable securities or something comparable to sort of impute what the value might be. And level three is where you really don't have much of an idea, and that's often where models were set up. I think Warren Buffett used the term something like valuation by models. I think it was by people's imagination or something like that, because you really didn't know what the value is. But that's something to watch, because I think before this European thing is finished, they may have to do something similar to what we did over here with our banks, which is to which is to inject government funds in them to keep them, the banks, from going insolvent, which could dramatically damage the economy because banks say it plays such an important role in financing both business and personal activities. Another example of this interconnectedness, a lot of money market funds, these are the funds you that hold very short-term securities. You can go in and out of them for a dollar. They do not want to bust the dollar, bust the buck, I guess is their term. In other words, it's very important that always be a dollar, not 99 cents. And so while they have, in some instances, been major investors in short-term debt of European banks, my understanding is most of those short-term debts have been paid off, and the money market funds have looked elsewhere to put their money rather than exposing themselves to the risk, to that risk. And there was a time when the Federal Reserve stepped in during this economic downturn in this country, in effect, to prop up the money market funds, to prevent a run on them, if you will, people cashing them in if it looked like they were going to be, or might even possibly be worth less than a dollar or a par. Another example of interconnectedness is most mortgage debt in Poland and Hungary is payable in Swiss francs. And you might say, well, why is that? Well, I suppose it was that at the time the loans were taken out, it was a better deal to borrow in Swiss francs than to borrow in other currencies. But obviously, with the rise in the value of the franc, that increases the debt burden by people who took those mortgages out at a lower level of valuation of the Swiss franc. I'm just giving examples of what I mean by systemic, how it's interconnected, and in ways like that which one might not even focus on. Making matters even worse is a lot of the debt of this troubled tier of the southern countries in Europe is very short-term debt. If it were longer-term debt, they might have time to work things out. But since it's short-term, they've got to pay it off or default when the debt comes too. And as a result, there isn't a lot of time to work things out. That's what actually happened with Lehman Brothers. They were operating with maybe 2%, that may be generous, 2% equity. But they could have continued to do that if those who were lending them money, much of which, by the way, was lent them overnight, it wasn't even for a week, night at a time. Once that dried up, they were gone. And at the time, the Fed would have loved to find somebody to buy, take them over, even if the government had to pay them to take it over. They couldn't find anybody to take Lehman over. And this issue of unraveling the worldwide activities of Lehman is taking place right now in bankruptcy courts, and it is a very, very slow process. Now, what's behind all this? Much is made, and properly so, that this was a market failure. Okay, yeah, I understand that. And I think it is an important explanation of the problems we've had here at home. Lenders taking unreasonable risks, securities being packaged in complex ways which the buyers didn't understand. They thought they were buying AAA paper, and it turned out to be a lot less valuable than that. And those of you who, as I understand it, might have been reading some of the advice to President Washington from his two of his three cabinet officers, Secretary of State, Secretary of the Treasury, recognize that these questions of national credit standing and all are, you know, go really way back. But I think there's more to this. I personally think that it's as much a failure of government as a failure of the market. And I don't say that to beat up on government. I think both the market and consumer sentiment and the government were influenced by a couple of fundamental beliefs which were widely shared in this country. One was if you have these two, you can, and they're really deep enough in the psyche, the culture of the country, you can see what happened. One is that home ownership is a valuable thing, and we should try to find a way that virtually everybody can own a home. communities are sounder, people take better care of their property, da, da, da. The second point is that the value of homes can never go down. If you believe both those things, why not make loans at zero with zero equity, which was actually happening in this country? Unless you think that's behind us, the FHA today is making loans, which is FHA, which is doing about 50% of the current lending in the United States. They're making loans with a 3.5% equity. I have no crystal ball, but it surely wouldn't surprise me if the average value of homes went down 3.5% before this thing is over, which could wipe out the equity of these new loans that are being made. So it isn't exactly like we have totally learned from my experience. Let me wrap this up by saying that I'm not a whole lot more confident in the wisdom of regulators than I am in the wisdom of markets. Alan Greenspan was a hero until he became a goat. When things started going poorly. There is a basic problem, however, in regulation, which I've seen over the years, and I think it is relevant to what I've been asked to talk about today, and that is that markets move more quickly than regulators can keep up with. Former wife of mine, I've had a couple of them, was a chairman of the Interstate Commerce Commission, and she said more than once, for every regulation, there's a way around it. Now, that may sound totally cynical, but there are people earning a hell of a lot of money in New York and Washington who are figuring a way around these new regulations, and the regulators have a very, very hard time keeping up with this. I ran into a quote a few days ago in a book I was reading, actually, about cybersecurity. By a very distinguished lawyer, he said, the law is always trying to catch up. I think that is a totally fair statement. It is part of it is the way our governmental system is created. It wasn't created to make it easy to pass laws. In fact, they wanted to make it difficult. They may just have succeeded beyond their fondest expectation in making hard to pass laws. But from a regulator's point of view, that is true. It is not easy to hire people in government today who fully understand all these new financial devices that are being used. And we found at the PCAOB that some of our most competent people who really got on top of this were hired away from us to go with hedge funds or to go to Wall Street. In fact, in the interest of full disclosure, because I don't think we ever disclosed this, we on several instances had meeting, a series of meetings where we invited people in from certain outside organizations, I'll be more specific in a moment, to try to explain to us, to make sure we really understood what was all this security packaging, how was this done, what were these highly risky ways in which these things were being offered to investors. One was Goldman Sachs. They were very very open, very candid. They described to us what they were doing. Not trying to defend them. They just said, here's what we're doing. And it was also very interesting when they described the risk approach that the organization had internally for deciding what they were going to actually do. It wasn't, at least so far as I know, rogue traders such as have undermined the confidence of some major international banks. These people were doing things that were approved at a high level. The other thing was rating services. Moody's people came down that met with us to explain in great detail how they went about rating these securities, which was also very useful in our work. There's some very bright people out there making a very good living trying to beat the system. And, well, frankly, it's hard to make these changes. If things are going well, and unemployment is low and prices are reasonably stable, as they were, seemed to be, prior to 2008, who's going to get up there and say we should increase the down payment for homes to 20%? Can you see that in a presidential candidate's platform? If elected, I will require you to put down 20% before you can buy a home. Come on. It's not really the way that the system works. I saw a very specific example of how only a crisis can bring about action by being a member of the Social Security Subcommittee when the Social Security system basically went broke back in 1982-83. It had to borrow from another trust fund of the government to get the checks out in the spring of 1983. Well, that created a situation which resulted in bipartisan action, Democratic Congress, Republican President. We increased taxes, we cut benefits. I was on the subcommittee, so that's why I say we. We extended the retirement age, which is gradually being increased for normal retirement age from 65 to 67. Why? Because there was a crisis, and something had to be done. And that crisis had been anticipated, and it had been forecast, and the trustees of the fund had talked about the shrinking balances and all that. But things had to get a lot worse than just a prediction before anything would actually happen. And there are conflicts in this. So we tighten up, as the government is going to do under Dodd-Frank. The lending authority of banks announced today or yesterday that we're going to put restrictions on the bank's ability to buy certain risky securities with their own capital. Okay. Bank of America announced they're going to charge $5 a month for people with debit accounts, and they get beat up. At the same time, the government is saying, strengthen your reserves, build up capital. But that's a mixed message. Build up capital, but don't do the things that you need to do to increase your profits. The only way to increase capital is either to reinvest earnings or have an anticipation of sufficient future earnings to get people to buy your stock at its current market values. There's no other way to do it. So I know it's an election year. It seems like every year it's an election year in this country in many, many respects. But these things do have consequence. Further, the tighter the regulation of banks, the more lending is going to be done by non-banks or by foreign banks, which are able to lend in the United States. And that's just a statement of fact. General Electric Capital is a very interesting example. GE Capital, which is a lender, but doesn't take deposit accounts, so they can do this. GE Capital is larger in its total size, its assets, and its investments than all but seven banks in the United States. And they're not even a bank. So this isn't just a hypothetical thing that can happen. Even when I was working at the Oversight Board, we could see these things happening. I think that regulation following the frauds, the accounting frauds back around the year 2000, 2001, has improved things. But I only have to mention the name Bernie Madoff to make the point that they haven't stopped. And I could give you a lot of other examples. One of the neatest ones is Parmalat. In Italy, where basically what the company did was create on the books assets which did not exist. And one of those assets was a supposed deposit of $4.9 billion in the Bank of America. And when the auditors came in, a letter, or fax, of what purported to be a letter was presented from the Bank of America saying, oh yes, there's a deposit of $4.9 billion for Parmalat in the Bank of America. It just happened that it didn't exist. So there we are. I want to quickly wind up by talking about that thing that we've been passing around. In Zimbabwe, you might have noticed that this currency actually has an issue date and an expiration date. I've never seen one like that before. In the year 1996, inflation in Zimbabwe was 4,000%. In the year 2007, by 2007, it was 66,000%, and I believe it was worse the year after this was issued. The dollar, on the other hand, is considered a safe place to put your money in the world's reserve currency. But what does it tell you? It doesn't say if you present it, you can get gold or silver. It just instructs you that this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. And that is to say, if you owe somebody a dollar and you give them a dollar, they got to accept it under the law. That's all that really means. So it still depends upon how the value is built. And behind that is the whole question of confidence. Once confidence is destroyed, and it was pretty well damaged here recently, it takes a long time to rebuild it. What does all of this mean in the United States? Well, you know, we can borrow as long as somebody's willing to lend to us, or as long as the Federal Reserve is willing to create money, which they have the power to do. But there are longer-range challenges, and they are not, I think, going to be, if history is any guide, to be easily overcome. Final note, a lot of people look at a situation like this, and all the elections and the debates and all that, and they say, well, these are Financial issues are all tied up in national issues that have to do with spending, entitlements, tax level of taxation, so forth. The next election will give the public a chance to speak to this issue, and it will help us to set a course looking forward. After one mid-year election, President Clinton, who knew a bit about these things, said, when he was asked about the election reports, he said, "The people have spoken. I just don't know what they said." And I close on that note because we do live in a world with uncertainty, where people of good faith interpret the same set of facts in diametrically opposed ways, and much of the public is totally turned off by this. And I look at it, I must admit, with a degree of bemusement, because to me, the play of ideas and arguments and issues is what government policy is all about. I don't really expect everybody to agree. I would like to see them come to agreement at some point, or at least compromise, and the movement away from that is a dramatic change from what I experienced during my over 30 years in elective office. But I understand why people are down on government and down on elected officials at all levels, but sometimes I think it's a bum rap. Sometimes we're asking them to do things that are, in a democratic society, extremely difficult to do because of the way in which we go about picking our leaders. Well, on that cheerful note, having used up all the time, I'm going to be around for a while. I know you have schedules, but I have time for a few questions for the whole group. But if there are, I'll take them. Otherwise, feel free. And it's not too late to get up there and shake your hand.